I would like, on behalf of all of us in the Academy, to welcome our guest speaker for the night and fellow of the Academy, Gunter Pauli. We've already circulated a bio for Gunter, but just in case anyone has missed it, he's an economist, an entrepreneur who I understand has started at least 10 companies over the last few decades. A member of the Club of Rome, who was actually introduced to us by Ivo Schloss, who is a Board of Trustees member for the Academy and also a longtime member of the Club of Rome. And of course, as you know, Gunter has an upcoming book on the blue economy. I've seen Gunter's presentation, as a few of you have, and I know that we're in for something very enjoyable and informative tonight. So with that, I would like to turn the meeting over to you, Gunter. We're going to mute all of the microphones during your presentation. Anyone who would have a question, you can raise your hand in the participants list. There's a place to raise your hand during the meeting. And then as soon as we will know and call on you as soon as Gunter's finished his presentation. If anyone has a problem during the meeting, you can use the chat facility to contact Lakshmi, the admin, and she will provide you all the assistance possible. I hope everything goes smoothly for everyone. Gunter, the meeting is yours. Your presentations are up here, and if you need anything, please tell us. Your mic is on mute now, so you'll have to unmute it.
So here I am on the speaker. Okay. I think this is working now. Do you hear me all?
Very clearly.
So I'm just going from the hypothesis that you indeed hear me.
Yes, we hear you clearly, Gunter. But now you're muted.
System up.
Gunter, we're hearing you.
Are you all hearing me?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm just learning how to play with it, and I made perhaps the mistake that Katharina, my wife, set everything up. So I'm a bit ignorant about what is to be done. But I do see the first page already of the presentation. I don't know how to do the buttons, but I'm sure that will sort itself out. Gary, first of all, thank you so much for organizing this and making it possible. It's as you know, 11 o'clock here in Singapore, and it's quite exciting to be in a global conference. And Bernard à Bruxelles, I'm glad to have you on there as well. It's an honor and a pleasure to have you joining this. You know, just 2 weeks ago, the Club of Rome accepted my book called Blue Economy as a report to the Club of Rome. And it's indeed a tremendous honor that, you know, knowing that the first report of the Club of Rome called Limits to Growth has made such an impact worldwide and is perhaps 35 years later taken more seriously than, you know, in 1972. But the main thrust of my book and my report is a very positive message. So for those who do not know me, I indeed would prefer to qualify as an entrepreneur somewhat around. And the key message is, though, that I realize that even though I set up a prominent eco-factory in Europe in 1992, it took me 2 years to realize that by having a biodegradable product, that at the same time I was destroying the rainforest in Indonesia, with these monoculture plantations, and I was destroying the habitat of the orangutan. And so it was a hard lesson that even though I was totally committed to environmental issues. And the second thing that I'm trying to do is cleaning the rivers in Europe, but by doing that, I was destroying the habitat of orangutan. And it was a hard lesson, really, to realize that biodegradability has nothing to see with sustainability. And that led me to the decision to really search for innovative ways to design a competitive business model where sustainability could be defined as the capacity to respond to the needs of all with what we have. And this is really how ecosystems work. Ecosystems are not just games of survival. It's not just the rules of evolution. It really is a fantastic interplay amongst all the living species in order to cascade nutrients and energy so that everyone can move from scarcity to abundance. And this is what was the inspiration when in 1994 I had the opportunity to work at the United Nations University with major funding from the Japanese government. I need to highlight that one of the reasons why I call it the blue economy is because we have two very specific experiences of what I would call the red economy. The communist system and the planned economy is basically not working. It didn't work, it isn't functioning, and anyone who has been monitoring the experiments of socialism in the past realizes that there is a tremendous limitation to that proposal. But then we had a second kind of red economy. And that was a red economy where we were expecting to have ever lower marginal cost prices through the implementation of massive economies of scale. And in order to ever increase the economy of scale, we were ready to go through huge mergers and acquisitions whereby we would be leveraging the assets. But you know, you can only leverage assets to a certain point. After that point, you are basing your financial instruments on something that really does not exist. And so the last 20 years, we built up this red economy after the collapse of the communist system in Eastern Europe, which basically is being celebrated this weekend. The red economy, for me, is an economy of debt, massive leveraging of assets, to the point that we have an economy based on something that does not even exist. And when Lehman Brothers went down on September 15 last year, very few people realized that the capital coverage ratio of Lehman Brothers was less than 3%. Now, just gotta imagine, less than 3% of capital coverage ratio means that you have assets free and you have debt 97. And you know, how could ever anyone expect that that kind of a financial leveraging could lead to a sustainable economy? It's absurd. And on top of that, people were then, who were making money in that kind of a crazy economy where nothing was based on something. In that crazy economy, there were offers like from Mr. Madoff that people would just get 15% return by doing nothing whatsoever. So the whole system was corrupt in its base, and it failed. Then we had the last 30 years, a lot of experimentations with what was called the green economy. I think the green economy is to be applauded and to be commended, and we have to recognize the tremendous efforts that so many people around the world have made in order to create the green economy. But unfortunately, the green economy seems to require that you invest more capital, or as a consumer you pay more for a product in order to save some of the environment and expect to have payback over time, even over generations. Now, When you're in an economy that is growing, you could find a few rich people who are prepared to do that. But most of these rich people made their fortune by exactly working in that economy that didn't exist, that red economy. And so therefore, expecting anyone else but the rich who got rich on the red economy to really get the green economy going is a false proposal. I noticed it, I observed it, I analyzed it, and therefore I have to come to the conclusion that it never took off. And when some of the projects do take off, they have such a tremendous collateral damage, or what we call unintended consequences, that we should really be humble and recognize that with the greatest energy of the greatest people committed to the environment, that economy never could reach more than 1 or 2% of the total world's economy. And as a result, the only thing that became sustainable was poverty. So therefore, I propose the blue economy. The green economy, I also have a problem with the word green, because green only recognizes and brings a salute to the plan. But when we look from the outside in the universe into our Earth, it is blue. It's the blue ocean, it's the blue sky, it's that blue Earth. It's the interplay of physics, chemistry, and biology. It is the capacity to cascade nutrients and energy from one kingdom to the other. It is a very different economy than we traditionally have known. But the most important thing that I learned from the ecosystems in that blue economy, in that wonderful Earth, is that it is possible, thanks to evolution over time, to invest less by innovating more, generating multiple revenues, and create jobs. Now, this is, to me, one of the most important observations that I can make early on, is that it is possible to innovate dramatically and generate jobs. For the past 50 years, we have been innovating in order to eliminate jobs. But we can now innovate and generate jobs because there is more value added generated, and there we generate multiple cash flows. And these cash flows are not solely to pay back the investors and the shareholders. It is a major opportunity to build up social capital. And the only way I have come to the conclusion that we can make this happen is not motivating multinationals to do it, but is to really stimulate millions of entrepreneurs to take the initiative. So hence, we come to this blue economy, where my analysis comes to the conclusion that within 10 years, with only 100 innovations, we could generate a minimum of 100 million jobs. Now, is this a pie dream? Is this reality? I know that very often people who listen to me are basically saying that, you know, this guy seems to believe his own dreams. Well, the analysis in the book highlights carefully, step by step, that these 100 innovations have already generated more than 25,000 jobs. So it is not something that is an idea. It has been benchmarked. Each and single one of these technologies has been analyzed, and multiple ones have been implemented, some small scale, some bigger scale, some really an impressive scale. And that is really what we want to bring to the public, is that if we want to stimulate the entrepreneurship, and the entrepreneurship at the micro scale is creating the environment that will shift the business at the macro scale. So it are millions of new business approaches at the micro level that will generate that new macro picture. And the macro picture for me is the picture of the blue economy. Now, how do we stimulate entrepreneurship? And the first one I must say is that there is no way that there is any space for entrepreneurship unless we think positive. Second, we have to learn creatively. We have to recognize that if we are 40 years old or 45 years old and plus, that whatever we learned at university is has most likely an expiration date that has already hit us. We think that our academic diplomas that gives us a license to operate for life. Wrong. We need to learn creatively, because what brought us from the past to the present is not going to take us to the future. And thirdly, what is the very important characteristic of the entrepreneurs is that they want to make things happen. They have a tremendous impatience. And in order to think positive and do the creative learning and making it happen, you have to have a business model that is based on innovative models of operation. Now, I would like to, from here on, simply share with you four very brief case studies that are mentioned and worked out in the book. In the book, we have in total 100 examples worked out. And here's the first one from Brazil. This case study, to me, is a very fundamental critique to the European Union and those who are obsessed with pumping CO2 into the deep ocean and into oil wells. We have to be very honest with ourselves that if you are the salesman of the hardware, you love these multi-billion proposals where you pump CO2 into the deep ocean. But we have to operate like natural systems did over millions of years. And whenever there was an excess of something, someone else always emerged in order to convert that excess into a resource. It's the food, the waste of one becomes the food for the other, belonging to another kingdom. So the project that has been implemented in Brazil, it was initiated in 1995. Under the leadership of our organization there in Brazil with Lucio Bruch. The academic leadership was with Jorge Alberto Vieira Costa of the Federal University of Rio Grande. And it is the conversion of the CO2, the 13% of CO2 in the flue gas from coal-fired power stations into probiotic food, biodiesel and jaw. Now, early on, the program that the Zero Foundation in Brazil had initiated was the farming of Spirulina platensis in the water from the very alkaline lakes in the southern part of Brazil in order to fight malnutrition. And you see here a picture of the kits that had been treated in these programs. Now, we realized that this actually worked. The government of Brazil purchased the spirulina and made it available for free distribution locally. But very soon we realized that we were making more spirulina than actually was needed in schools. Now, what a tremendous opportunity. We went from scarcity to abundance. Now, anyone who has been trained as an economist like myself, we're kind of brainwashed about scarcity. Scarcity is why the economist has a reason to exist. Now, of course, if you eliminate the concept of scarcity, and if scarcity would ever succeed in being eliminated, well, then in the meantime, you've eliminated the economist as well. Now, the overproduction of spirulina platensis led us to find opportunities to convert the lipids in the spirulina into biofuel. And just about a year ago, the leftover of this extraction process of biofuel led to the identification of the membranes of those algae, and these membranes are esters that can be converted in polyesters. Now, what I would like to point out is that this, from a very simple initiative 14 years ago, this has evolved into a major academic program in parallel with the multiple projects from a small scale to a bigger scale that have been initiated. Today, the Federal University of Rio Grande has 35 Masters of Science in Algae and 7 PhDs. And Saint Piquet, the Brazilian Science Network, has just awarded an additional $1 million so that in within 5 years, we could have an additional 4 PhDs in algae. And I think this is to be applauded. The Brazilian government, which has demonstrated so much fresh approaches to energy issues, no one in the world recognizes the innovative approaches of the Brazilian government to algae. But the mere fact that we are being able to operate in one of the five coal-fired power stations and benchmark the conversion of CO2 into fuel, food, and find chemicals for the cosmetics industry. Plus, as you can all imagine, one can generate carbon credits. The bottom line of it is means that we have four cash flows coming from CO2 from a coal-fired power station. And we are just, and I am, must say, I'm just flabbergasted by the approach of Europeans and the approach of the world in general to consider CO2 as a problem and not as a resource. Let me switch to the next example, which is polymers, or in simple terms, it is in terms of plastics. Natural systems produce polymers from amino acids. It's done by the bees, the ants, the moths, the spiders, and never ever is one using petroleum or cornstarch. Interesting thing is that whereas silk has been eliminated as a polymer for clothing, silk is increasingly positioning itself as a core competitor and a substitute to titanium. It doesn't need to have a lot of explanation, but titanium is a expensive product. It is a mine product that is processed at high energy costs. And worse than that, titanium requires bathing in argon gas, because titanium in oxygen simply oxidizes. And so we have four competing products already approved on the European market. But what I think is more interesting is the science behind the conversion of the silk, the raw silk produced by the mulberry moth, and converted simply by using pressure and humidity content to the high-performance silk that is made by spiders. Spiders have a mainly non-crystalline silk structure, whereas the moth has a increasingly crystalline structure. And so to decrystallize, to convert crystalline to the non-crystalline, that is really the major contribution that has been made in the process of the science that is fine-tuned by the Department of Zoology at Oxford University. Here you see the machine. This is a very simple machine that extracts and produces the silk exactly in the same way as it is done in the guts of the spider. But the raw material that is used in this machine on the left side, the machine is manufactured in Aachen in Germany and has been designed thanks to the tremendous work of Professor Fritz Wolra. This machine produces the silk as if it were a spider, using the raw material of the raw silk of the mulberry worm. And I think this is an opportunity. Here you see a brief image of the challenge that we are launching. Mind you, I have talked to Procter & Gamble, who's the owner of Gillette. I have talked to Procter & Gamble just 3 weeks ago. They are quite shocked, because look at this Gillette Mac 3. We don't stop and think and reflect on the fact that any one of us who's shaving their face and using a modern day razor, that altogether we are throwing about 100,000 tons of titanium into the landfills every year. Now, the cutting blade, which was a great invention of Gillette, has been replaced in our design system by silk, nanoscale silk threads. Now, you're cutting over you're rolling this over your face in a very similar fashion as we used to cut our grass. We roll those knives over it, and we know extremely well that this cuts very well. Now, it cuts so well, so efficiently, that we do know that one can cut into the keratin, but never into the skin. The advantage is that the cost of stainless steel and titanium is high, and that on the other hand, the cost of the silk is rather low. So the core raw material silk that can cut through keratin is half of the cost of the stainless steel and the titanium proposal. The beauty is that when you use silk, you have no metals, no petroleum, and no landfill. But then we can come back to the real value of the silkworm, is that 1 ton of raw silk per year generates 9 tons of fertilizer. This is fascinating, because if you are shaving with silk, then you are producing fertilizers that permit you to recover the topsoil. And this is exactly what the Chinese pioneered 5,000 years ago. The Chinese were never planting mulberry trees to have silk. They planted mulberry trees because they knew that 50% plus of the leaves would be eaten by the caterpillars, and that these caterpillars would produce massive amounts of fruit that could then be generated into a topsoil. So the Chinese looked at the mulberry tree as an option for the regeneration of topsoil in order to meet the need for food for their expanding population 5,000 years ago, and silk was mainly the byproduct that emerged when the empress one day was sitting with a cup of tea under a mulberry tree. A cocoon fell into her cup. She desperately tried to get out of it, and when she got it out, she realized she had 300 meters of thread in her hand. And silk, the byproduct though, now permits us to see that if we are substituting not just a petroleum product with a biocompatible product, but we're substituting an ecosystem of destruction whereby you're mining, you're burning, you're doing high energy content, you're using argon gases, you are releasing massively CO2 in the environment. You substitute that with a very simple system whereby you not only have 1/3 in your product as fuel carbon, meaning you're sinking carbon into your soil, because you're sinking carbon in the trees, you're sinking it into your topsoil, and you're generating millions of jobs in the same time. I'm jumping over a little small detail because I see I'm going a little bit over time. If we are substituting the 100,000 tons of titanium with 100,000 tons of silk, then we're going to need 250,000 hectares of newly planted mulberry trees on arid land that today is not qualified for agriculture. Now, this is the impact of substituting a gilet made out of titanium with maybe a gilet or a chic or a Bic made out of silk. And I think these are the kind of innovations that we need, because in the process, we're seeing that 2 million jobs could be generated. And this is where we make such a huge difference. We're not only talking about substituting one product with the other, we're substituting one system with another system, but by substituting one system by the other system, we're generating millions of jobs. Now, those of you who know me a little bit better over the years, you know that I've always been very keen on looking at coffee waste and asking ourselves the question, how do natural systems reuse organic waste? And it's obvious that it's never sent to a landfill or an incinerator. The waste of food, the waste of one is food for another, belonging to another kingdom. No one basically eats his own waste, unless you're a dog and you want to vomit, or you promote mad cow disease as the European Union was doing for a while. Now, the real question that we ask ourselves is, how can we apply this in very concrete circumstances? And when you have a coffee bean, you have 100% of a biomass. In your cup of coffee, you only have 0.2%. Now, either you think negative, and then you wonder, what have we done wrong, and how could we correct the bad? Or you think positive, and you say, the potential of these 99.8%, if we would be able to use it, is to generate 500 times more. And this is exactly what we have done by converting the waste of the coffee into a substrate for shiitake, and the waste of the shiitake mushrooms to be converted to feed for animals. It's the kingdom of the plants, to the kingdom of the fungi, to the kingdom of the animals. And this cascading permits us to produce shiitake at a tenth of the cost of the standard in China. Now, here are just the three of our women leaders who are doing that in three continents in the world. But I would like to go for a second a little bit deeper into the concrete example of Chile Guerrero, where we have been able to work with her, admire her work, support her, and we just recently took the initiative to go to Chitinge, the region of Zimbabwe that was producing coffee up to 10 years ago. The coffee got into complete disarray for reasons we don't have to go into much detail, but here is Chido reaching out to the most fragile populations, young women, single mothers, orphan girls, and the women over 50. Most of the time, these are the people that are totally neglected, fight malnutrition with great difficulty. And what we have done in order to finance that operation, and I remember one of the people who introduced themselves said, I'm in San Rafael. Well, we're doing this project with a boutique roaster in San Rafael, California, called Equator Coffee and Tea. And Equator launched the Cheetos blend. It's a coffee whereby we commit that whatever is the waste of the coffee on the farm, all that waste is going to be regenerated into food for women and those who we typically do not reach to. Now, this year, we have relaunched the export of coffee from Zimbabwe. 6 containers have left. Now, if you have on one hand the cash crop, but the sale of the cash crop is now the basis of food security, I cannot insist enough. This is a major shift in thinking on our globalization of markets. Traditionally, when you had a cash crop that is exported, you had poverty that was left behind. Now, if you don't have food security, then you have abuse. Now, if you do have food security, it eliminates the abuse, and when there's no abuse, there's no sex trade. And we feel that this is the real power, the real purchasing power of the consumers. This product is not sold at a premium price. It is sold as competitively as anything else. We're not asking to pay more. The normal price is paid. But we have secured that the supply chain from the farm over the roaster to the consumer is shortened so that the distribution becomes available. Yeah.
We are not hearing you now. Luckily, are you hearing me?
I hear you very well. I hear you. I continue to hear you. I'm over the...
I'm hearing, Gunther. Who is not hearing? Jackie?
This is the matter. I was hearing fine, thank you.
Okay, so I can continue?
Yes.
Okay, I will just continue then. So here we have this initiative whereby we can see that by simply positioning a coffee, not at a higher cost, but at a competitive cost, but by converting the waste from the export, eliminating the waste, that we can eliminate the hunger, we can eliminate abuse, we can eliminate the sex trade. And I think this is such a rewarding constatation that when we are prepared to think into these systemic approaches where we operate like an ecosystem, then we can really make a difference. And you know, we go beyond fair trade and organic. Fair trade and organic have made great contributions in the past, and we have done great efforts, but it was still part of the green economy where we're trying to do something that is a bit more expensive in order to get a little bit less damage to the earth. Now, I would like to remind anyone of you who's in the audience listening here that when you have organic, certified organic, then you have certified what is not in the coffee. You don't know what's in the coffee. And we believe that these were great steps in the 60s and the 70s, but by now we need to go over and beyond and do better. And that better is, for example, this proposal. Now, we have to realize that there are 25 million coffee farms in the world. From our experience in Colombia, where we have already more than 10,000 people working in this, every coffee farm could generate 2 jobs. Now, if you have 25 million coffee farms, that means you have a potential for rural job generation of the order of 50 million. And that is not all, because we generate food with this, generate food in the form of protein from mushrooms and protein from animals. And if we combine that, we see a tremendous opportunity to generate nothing less than 60 million tons of food based on the waste of coffee only. Now, the same applies to pruning from orchards, apple orchards, peach orchards. The same applies for corn crops. The same applies to seaweeds. It is quite an amazing thing that we have learned how to discard agro waste, biological waste, and if it's fibrous, it can generate food. I think this is, to me, one of the great cases where we demonstrate that we can indeed generate food and move out of the poverty trap into the opportunity of abundance. The final case I would like to present is Gaviota's. Now, Gaviota's still here, announced as a cover story on CNN Money. I'm glad to report that about 3 weeks ago, it was on the cover of the New York Times, and it was the second page, full page, in the International Herald Tribune. It's the first time, basically, that in the American media we have such an attention. Even though the book by Alan Weisman had already been written 10 years ago. For those who do not know Las Gaviotas, here it is in the Vichada in Colombia, close to the Orinoco Basin. And there you see on the left side the land that it used to be, i.e. a denuded land with 17 plant species, of which 11 grasses are non-native, regenerated over 25 years into a forest that originally was solely dependent on pine trees and has now already 256 species. The article in it was peer group reviewed and published in Scientific Journal of the Academy of Sciences. Now, one of the great breakthroughs of Gaviotas is that in the last 10 years, it has started to produce its own biofuel. Now, the biofuels that are made in Gaviotas are of different natures, but one innovation that has been introduced is that the biofuels are generated by the resin tapped from the trees. Now, the resin is 70% colophon, 30% turpentine. And the turpentine is locally reprocessed so that all the impurities up to 10 micron are eliminated. And as a result, Gaviotas now can use the turpentine from the trees to fuel both motorbikes and diesel engines, the diesel tractors. Now, the business model that has emerged in Gaviotas is one of these typical systemic business models of the blue economy, whereby with one investment you have multiple cash flows generated. Now, the revenues generated, the positive cash flow generated, is not paid out to shareholders. It is used to plant more forest. Now, if you were to buy the biofuels in Colombia for 25 years, then over 25 years, you fund the regeneration of an additional 8 hectares of forest. And that is a tremendous opportunity. Now, if you plant a forest, the 1,000 trees that planted, 700 trees must be eliminated. That means you have access to wood for multiple purposes. You fix carbon dioxide. Now, I like to insist on it. This is a green economy. this is not just a simple green economy whereby we reduce your CO2 emissions. You are burning fuel produced by a biodiversity and you fix CO2 in the process. After 3 years of operating, the first biofuels start being naturally generated by those 8 hectares of rainforest that have been regenerated, producing your own biofuels, creating 2 full-time jobs, and perhaps the most important, produce free water for the local population. Now, what more do you want? Well, I'd like to highlight, and I have presented this to the CEO Summit here in Singapore, to the great surprise of many of the executives present, that the original acquisition of the land only cost $1 per acre. Today, 25 years later, the land is valued at $3,000 an acre. Mind you, that is a better result than if you were to have invested in Microsoft's first IPO 25 years, holding on to that share. You have a lesser income than with this operation. Now, the $3,000 an acre is not for me, is not for the foundation. It is revenues for the cooperative in Gaviotas. And therefore, we can demonstrate that investing in the regeneration of a forest brings you a better return than Microsoft, and it builds social capital. I would like to conclude here and say that in line with my great mentor, who I had the opportunity to work with for several months as a young man in Japan, Mr. Shuichiro Honda. Mr. Honda had a live motto which stated that some people dream to escape reality and others, they dream change reality forever. I thank you very much for going through this with me. Here is the cover of the Blue Economy. We are publishing it in several languages, but perhaps what for some of you may be very interesting is that as of February 2010, I am planning to present every week a new business model like the 4 that I've presented here. Every week for 2 years, a new business model will be presented that I hope will help stimulate entrepreneurs. And this cascading and this flow of new opportunities is going to present it as an open source material. And perhaps at a later stage, Erin could qualify a little bit how we're planning to do that and how it operates. Gary, over to you.
Jackie, could you chair the session, please?
Hi, yes. Thank you, Gary. Hello, Gunther. Thank you very much for the talk that you have given. Hi, how are you? I don't know how technical. Because many of our participants are with the IT area, and but let me quickly summarize for the group. The first part has been the principles of sustainability, which I think that John Cox or another person, Bob, might be able to comment on later on. And then Gunther, I have been. The 4 case studies that you have given, they are actually very, very interesting. The first one being the one in Brazil, and that is basically the use of algae and then converting it into food for malnutrition case study. And then later on, using the same algae to produce and the lipids to produce biofuel. And the next one that you talked about was the polymer using silk. And that I think is very, very interesting. I actually could not imagine that silk could be used to see your beard.
Yeah.
And so, and that is great. And the other one, the third one is on coffee waste. Coffee waste, which has been thrown away, is then now converted into food and animal feed. And the fourth one, in Brazil, when the attempt to reforest land is now yielding biofuels from the resin of the tree. So basically, in these five overall topics, what I understand is we see that new products from different ways have been created, and what is happening is jobs have been created along with it. Understand the blue economy is about new thinking that is then used to generate jobs. I have been informed that there have been two hands up for questions and discussion. The first has been Roy, and the second has been Bernard. So let me now pass pass the floor to Roy Posner from San Francisco.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, right.
Thanks for a wonderful presentation. It was every moment was enjoyable to me. Aside from the four practical examples of the theory itself is really what moved me the most, and this will form into a question eventually. It seems that the normal model in the world is to invest first, and based on the money to innovate, and based on that creating cash flow and jobs. And you're kind of saying the reverse. You start with creativity, entrepreneurship, innovation, and that ends up generating jobs and cash flow. I mean, that's pretty dramatic reversal of thinking, and I'm just wondering, in general, how many people appreciate that reversal of idea, and if you had any other thoughts, or maybe even discuss what led you to that concept. I realize you addressed that slightly in the beginning. I'm asking if you have any other thoughts on that reversal of thinking.
Thank you, Roy. I think the economists are the ones who really should put on the hot seat. Now, I've been trained as an economist myself, and I have to simply admit that definitely those who have a degree in economics should have an expiration date at the year 2008. Anyone who graduated before 2008 should have their diploma rescinded because it just simply expired. And I think you really touched upon it in a very direct way. The economist typically starts with the issue of a scarcity that is then sublimated into a market demand. And so scarcity and market demand have to be met by the invisible hand that will allocate the scarce resources to those who are the most efficient ones. And there indeed you see this whole process of the need to plan. So basically the the way that we have proceeded with our scarcity on the market is to plan everything. I mean, if I can give you the simple example, if you go to an entrepreneurship course at any of the business schools in America, from Harvard to Stanford to Berkeley, etc., then you will be requested to write a business plan. Now, a business plan where you are predicting, without ever having done it yourself and never having done the actual business implementation, to put up a plan for 5 years is the same as the Communist Party was doing in order to fulfill the needs of the people by planning production for 5 years. Because what is happening? Once you then are in charge, then you're going to do everything you can to have your plan executed as you imagined it. And that means that at whatever cost. And here we see a major difference, and it's absolutely true, Roy. We start from the innovative appreciation that we are not in a world that is condemned by scarcity, but we're in a world that has the opportunity to evolve to sufficiency and abundance. And it's that switch where we will recognize the innovation that will move us from scarcity to sufficiency and abundance. And it is, to me, therefore, the first example that I mentioned from Brazil, because I have to admit to you that in 1995, when the program started, we could not imagine that we would solve a malnutrition issue with spirulina around the city of Rio Grande in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. We could not imagine. Today, it has happened. And I think if we are prepared to take the entrepreneurial innovation and the risk-taking related to it, then I actually must say that the second major error of the economists has been to assess the issue of risk. If you are not supplying 1 billion people in the world with water, or 1 billion people in the world do not have food, what is the risk that you're taking in order to supply them with water and food? You can't lose. These are basic needs. And so the risk assessment needs to be thought through in a very different manner. And I believe that that is one of the other issues that we have to recognize. Because if we're capable of rethinking the risk issue by meeting basic needs of everyone on this earth, then we will be able to reassess the role that these entrepreneurs are playing in, for example, reversing the risk of climate change. Because climate change is a huge risk as long as we stay within the core business, core competence approach. But once we are prepared to enter into the systemic thinking where we have multiple innovations easily clustered together in order to respond to the basic needs, then we also see the opportunity to reverse the risk of climate change into a huge opportunity to finally come onto a pathway towards sustainability.
Okay, thank you, Gunther. Can I now ask Bernard? Bernard was on,
yes,
on the second
day. Yes, thank you. Gunther, I've been an admirer of your work for many years, and I'm actually the first time I have the pleasure of seeing you in person. there's something that was triggered by your expose, which actually I believe relates to the common blind spot that capitalism and communism has in the entire field of economics, which happens to be that the idea that we need a monopoly of a single bank debt currency that has, and that currency has a characteristic that it needs to be scarcer than its usefulness in order to be able to keep its value. So the problem that you're highlighting in economic theory happens to be based, rooted in that assumption, which happens to be common to both the communist system and the capitalist system. The only difference between the two is that in the communist system you have the government owning the banks. In the Western system, it's the private sector that owns the bank. Yeah, well, sure. Accidentally. They're trying to get rid of it as quickly as possible. But the point is, the system is not questioned. And actually, what I was thinking is, have you thought of the possibility of tracking your flows of materials in another currency than the conventional money? Because that way you can actually create an economy that actually values the products at a different stages in another way than the conventional way where you basically say it's waste. In other words, it's something to get rid of. Because it's only not waste when you have the rest of the system that can absorb it. Right? So you need to have an integrated approach. And if you use a currency that actually is the currency for that particular flow, okay, and you value that currency within your integrated system, you will have economics actually working, including business cycles working. You know, in other words, you can create a business circuit that as a whole does this. So my question is, have you thought about that? Or is there a way of, I would be delighted to collaborate with you in order to design such an approach, because I believe there is, the currency innovation is also necessary to do what you're talking about.
Well, I'm, thank you so much, Bernard, for your question, and we have a common friend who is known less than Margaret Kennedy, and
of course.
who has been polluting my mind with those good thoughts. So the case of Las Gaviotas, you would be interested to know that there is no currency at Gaviotas, no currency at all. There's no money. So we in general don't highlight it too much because the case is already crazy enough, and if we then come with a message that there's no currency, then all the outside critics are convinced we must be a sect. I mean, this has got to be some kind of a Buddhist crazy type of new sect. So we don't want to push the logic of people too far, but I think within this audience, we have the opportunity to nevertheless share the reality of the situation. We don't have the level of sophistication, Bernard, as you and Margaret have on currency, but we are very much on that wavelength. And we track something that what currencies do not actually tell us. We track the value added that can be generated. And the value added is nearly never measured in currency, in monetary terms. It is first and foremost measured in the responding to basic needs of the local population. Concrete example. When we're looking at water being produced by the newly generated rainforest, well, the water before was a water of a very low pH, pH 4. Now, the water now is a water of a pH 6.8. Now, that has immediately an impact on health. Now, when your local population in the previous system was suffering from 70% gastrointestinal diseases, and now they're healthy on top of that, they're riding the bicycle 2 hours a day, then you have a different population. You get more value for what you've done, because the original value would have been planting trees and save the earth. No, this is planting trees, providing drinking water, and having healthier people. And it is the value-added tracking that we see that has permitted these systems to really build up the social capital. But we did need to go through an analysis, Bernard, which is the very capitalistic analysis, is how much is the land worth? Now, we all know that land that has no water and produces nothing is worthless. And we all know that land that has water and that produces food and has healthy people living on it is high worth. And so I think there is an opportunity, Bernard, to be able for us to benefit from your sophistication.
Yes, I heard you, Gunther. And in fact, what I believe you're saying is you could actually, with your flow of goods, that you say you have a value added, if you are valuing that, you must have quantities that you actually value. Biomass, for example, or protein, or whatever that goes through your system that in that particular circuit is the material that actually is a common ground to the entire circuit that closes the circuit. That is what I meant you could actually use as a currency. It doesn't have to be used as a currency for people to exchange among themselves, but it is a currency between the businesses that actually are involved in that particular sequence of production flows.
Actually,
am I clear there?
Yes, you're very clear, and I think through the dialogue we can give it more substance. For example, if we look at the coffee case, basically we are improving the generation of amino acids for human consumption. As we all know, coffee has nearly no amino acids for human consumption, and therefore it is an export crop that generates poverty and malnutrition. Because if you optimize your capacity to produce coffee, then you will have decreased your capacity to feed your own people. Now, by using the waste of the coffee, you generate protein through the mushrooms, and by using the waste of the mushrooms to feed the animals, you now have mushroom-based proteins, and you have animal protein, which are two proteinic sources that you traditionally did not have. And as such, the same logic applies if we would use, and I thank you for that idea, then if we would use protein as a one of the currencies, then indeed we see the same is happening with CO2 and Spirulina platensis. The CO2 gets converted to Spirulina platensis. The spirulina has up to 80% protein content. And then you have the lipids, and that would then be another currency, because the lipids, the fat, can be converted to a fuel. And here you have a fuel currency that emerges. And the same fuel currencies we actually see coming up in parallel next to the protein in the ecosystem of the rainforest, because the currency is the turpentine now. But the turpentine is basically one of the fuels. And I thank you very much, Bernard, because I think this is a very, very interesting line of thought that should be given much more reflection and depth, and could enrich the, let's call it, could enrich the blue economy.
I would be delighted to work with you on that one, because I believe that's the track to reconcile conventional economic and business planning with what you're trying to do, where you actually provide flows that are traceable and are exchangeable. In other words, why not have, because it's not going to be, of course, if you have a fully integrated business where a single company does it all, you don't need that coordination issue. But that is not necessarily the best model. You know, the people that will make, the razor blades are not the same people that make the silk, you know. So, in other words, having an exchange mechanism between them when it actually attracts value, that may have a dollar value at the end or at some point, but not necessarily the places where you measure them, you know, conventionally. And that would be probably the solution. Anyway, brilliant stuff you have been doing there.
You know, Bernard, I'd just like to round this up. I can very well imagine, Bernard, that we would have, for food, we take protein as the currency. For water, of course, it's water. And then we have energy where we have a calorific value attached. And I think we could go one by one of the basic needs as defined within the Millennium Goals that includes health. And then what is the typical effect in economics is the catalyst. I mean, is the catalytic effect of certain investments. Now, we do know that when you have water, you have health. If you have water, you have better protein production. And so you see how by generating the pool currency flowing within the system, you actually have a logic, and that would be a very interesting mathematical model to develop there, Matt, where we would have the logic of basically taking that rainforest of gaviotas and showing why the land value could go factor 3,000 over 25 years.
Thank you. I believe you have a key here for important things.
For more work.
Yeah. And I'm happy to play with you. Just give you that message. I'm happy. If you ever come to Europe, we should finally meet.
We should. You're in Brussels, so my sons are now studying Brussels.
So, double excuse to come.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Bernard. Thank you, Gunther. Gary indicated that we more or less stop in 20 minutes. We still have a lot of time. I have, as indicated by Lakshmi, who is basically, she's running the background for all of us. She has indicated that we have two hands up. One is from Gary Jacobs, and the fourth person will be John Cox. Can I call Gary? Yes, Gary. You have something for Gunther?
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Jackie. And Gunther, thank you very much for a fascinating, stimulating, and very informative presentation. I know this is a great challenge for you to present so much material, so much thought and fact in a very brief period of time. It's equally or more challenging for us to keep up with you and to absorb as much as you are presenting so quickly. I was anxious to hand over control of the meeting because we've been having heavy rain in South India, and my DSL connection has become problematic, and I wanted to be sure that the rest of the meeting was not affected by that. I'd just like to mention something and then ask a few questions. I thought it was interesting that you came up with the number 100 million jobs. That was very interesting to me because in the early 90s, our society, the Mother Service Society, and the International Commission on Peace and Food, where I was executive director, we did a study for the, presented to the government of India, a strategy to create 100 million jobs in India in 10 years. So your 10 years and your 100 million jobs was exactly the finding that we had. Of course, we're talking globally, but I would suggest that probably the numbers are I'm trying to suggest that the numbers are, if anything, greater, not less, than what you have estimated. It was also quite an interesting coincidence for me that at least two of your projects that you mentioned in your note, the silk and the bamboo, were both potentials that we too had identified much earlier, though I must say your approach is much more environmentally sound. Our priority was on creating jobs. You have taken a much more integrated and appealing approach to it. So I'd just like to say that our own research certainly confirms the employment potential, the magnitude of the employment potential that you're talking about. I think it's very important that we explore as far as we can how these strategies and programs could be implemented. I have a couple of questions. One is, where would be the best, we're all looking forward to your book when it comes out, but being impatient as we are, where could we look for additional information on the job potential, and particularly, I'm particularly interested in programs that might be applied in countries like India. That's one question. Second question is, you mentioned about 50 million jobs could be created just with coffee alone. I don't know whether that has any relevance to tea as well. India has a good deal of coffee, but even perhaps more tea. Whether there's a relevance there, and how we could learn more about the employment potential of these programs for a country like India. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Gary. Let me just say first and foremost that you were very right at the outset of your comments. The amount of information that we have pulled together is so huge that it is it's an overflow. It's too much, and therefore we have decided to basically pace the information over time. And that's why we've taken the initiative that as of February, every week we're presenting one case. Every week one. So it doesn't come like an overload all at once, where people are going to skim through and not have the capacity to digest the depth of the opportunity that each one of these cases has. So that starts in February 2010. It will be organized out of Spain, because Spain will be chairing the European Union for the first 6 months of 2010. So I'm going to ask you a little bit of patience, but in the book I have an annex of 25 pages where I explain technology per technology, innovation per innovation, the present amount number of jobs generated, and the potential that we conservatively can see. And your question at the end is right on, it's spot on, Gary. Coffee and tea are exactly the same. Tea, only the new leaves are being used, and everything else is basically considered, well, not everything else, I mean, they don't kill the plants because it's perennial, but you have an awful lot of waste being generated in drinking tea as well. And so if we are combining corn cobs, tea, prunings of apple orchards, etc., we're looking at a potential way beyond the 50 million. Now, why do we mention the 50 million? Because we can substantiate with very concrete cases in a few countries that this is the potential. And I think what we need at this moment, where there are too many people doing greenwashing and too many people are promising the sky and delivering hell, we need to have more cases where people can say, okay, I give you the benefit of the doubt, let me go and look. And then we can take people on the tour. Just the last 12 months, 104 companies were established in Colombia converting coffee waste to mushrooms. 104. And we know exactly who's in charge, and we document that. And I think this is going to be one of the most powerful tools, that when we can continuously show how it works. But then you need a second step. And that second step is that you need to show people how. And we have decided to do this open source. That means I cannot imagine, and I cannot agree with the European Union policy, as you may have heard, that the European Union has refused to provide technologies to reduce the impact on climate change for free to the third world. That means climate change has become a business for the European Union. I mean, how do you ever want to get to 350 ppm if you want to get business out of the proposal? And if that's the vision of the policymakers who are the most advanced thinkers on climate change in the world, well, let's not expect anything from Copenhagen in the process. And so, therefore, our approach has been, okay, if you now would like to know how it is possible to generate a razor from silk that will cut through the keratin, well, we make agreements with the scientists that we can publish that. We can make it available. And we will even say where you can buy the machines. And that is not because we are the ones who are going to make the money in it. It's because we want to unleash the entrepreneurs to have thousands of initiatives, so that instead of this present duopoly between Bic and Gillette, that finally another 1,000 players can come to the market.
Thank you so much for your response, Spencer, and you certainly have us looking forward eagerly to next year. I would just like to close my comments. I know we're running short and others are waiting. With two statements. One, I was happy that you and Bernard connect. For the rest of you on the call, Bernard will be our guest speaker for the next webcast, and you'll be getting notification of that in a couple of days. On the complementary currencies, which of course he has been working on for many years. Gunther, I'd just like to say that we in the GEC, in our conference, as well as in the Academy, as you are a fellow, we would certainly like to explore with you what role the Academy could play in promoting this approach. I think that if our fellows had really understood the full scope and depth of what you're proposing and talking about, I think we will find a very, very wide and deep interest among our fellows. So I would like to discuss with you subsequently and explore with you ways in which we can leverage the network that the Academy has to further this very important work that you're doing. Thank you again.
Gary, thank you very much. And I think Erin was online earlier. She had to go, I know, somewhere else as well. But I think you can coordinate with Erin, since she would be in charge of seeing how we can best involve as many people as possible in getting the dialogue going, in getting more depth and understanding of what's going on, and in order to see more action on the ground.
Very good. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Well, Gunther, just a passing comment. I am very happy to hear about the open source information, which basically, as you said, allows people to find out how to do it. And I think, I mean, even in my work, one of the biggest missing things is how to do things. And I hope through the open source, we will be able to solve some of the problems. Okay? Well, passing on, we have basically about 10 minutes. Other than John, Ashok has also wanted to pose a question. So now let me pass it to John Cox. John Cox?
Thanks, Jackie. This is John Cox. I know that we are very squeezed for time, so let me say two or three things. One is, Gunther, thanks a million. This was a powerfully creative experience that I have watched you articulate. Now, thank you very much for doing it. Turns me on. I want to make another comment. Somehow, at this point, at this early point in this project between you and Bernard and Randall, I think we're looking at what might be a real potential to create a new paradigm in economic thinking that will replace what exists today. And what exists today, we all know, is very difficult. That's one thing. Second thing, you may or may not know that I've been drinking a cup of coffee during this whole thing, and coincidentally, about 3 weeks ago, in San Rafael, if you can see this or not, I am now drinking coffee called Decaffeinated Mexico Motozitla, which is a new brand that Equator here in San Rafael is marketing. And it is the best coffee that I've ever tasted, I have to say that. Secondly, they are selling it at a premium price, which turns me on. And that suggests that the potential for entrepreneurship at the micro level is being realized, and the value added is going to be passed through to a whole array of things. So it's how that process may cascade turns me on. Finally, two things. One is I want to pose two questions. You don't have to answer it now, Gunther, but maybe this is a question that all of us can to think about. Is that, to what extent does the blue economy concept and the whole systems concept drive an imperativeness to do it and to do it fast? And to look at that in a total context, how can that question be answered in a way that will more rapidly influence policymakers around the world? That's the question I'm posing that maybe we can all can work on. And secondly, if that message gets transmitted broadly enough, what will it take to make that happen as we look at a global full employment, sustainable full employment potential in the world? Those are just my two questions, and I'm sorry to bother you. But again, thank you very much, Gunter. It was just terrific.
Well, thank you. And you know, I would say, please try the Zimbabwe, Cheetos blend as well. And compare your Mexican and your Zimbabwean one, and let me know what's the best. In the end of the day, we have to have good coffee. Your question on the policy mix is very important, and, I'm very fortunate that, Akin Steiner, the executive director of UNEP, Ashok Kosla, the president of IUCN, have both agreed not only to write the foreword to the book, but they are actively promoting in their initiative the contents of the book. When it comes to governments, I must say we are in some sense very lucky that unemployment is not going to go down with the so-called new revival of the economy. Unemployment is going to stay where it is, and it's going to get worse. I mean, America's at 10.2% unemployment, and it ain't going to go away. And I think this is where we see a tremendous opportunity, because that is where politicians are willing to listen. Because that's the sensitive part. And that is why the title of the book has been changed originally to highlight the opportunity in the question of carbon. And make it a Copenhagen book. But I felt that the long term, what we really are in need of is a strategy to imagine full employment.
Thank you, Gunter. I want to say one more thing. I've read several of your papers, and they're just terrific. What I missed, maybe I didn't read it carefully enough, was your ability to contrast the blue economy from the red economy from the green economy. And I think that putting it in that context is a powerful reason, basis, upon which to promote this thing more publicly. It was wonderfully explained today in your presentation.
Can we now move on to Ashok?
Sir, from your description of your economy, your model of your economy, I understand your model of the economy is something that is aligned with nature's way of functioning. So I thought it would be very fitting had you described your economy as green economy, but surprisingly you have chosen to describe it as blue economy. Blue is something that I associate with the sea or the sky, not with the ground. So in what is the meaning in which you have used the word blue here? Does it mean sustainability or?
Ashok, I mean, I am very uncomfortable with the massive greenwashing that is going on. I mean, there is so much greenwash. It is embarrassing. People call genetically modified corn from Cargill is called a green plastic. I don't understand it. Biofuels made from Yatropha, where a plant originated from Latin America, is intensively cultivated in India using techniques of extraction that I must say is cannot be considered sustainable. And so I really want to make a distinction between what has become the greenwash and the green wave that has not succeeded in getting us towards sustainability. It's my own experience as well. We were producing the most biodegradable products in Europe, and I was destroying the rainforest in Indonesia, and I did not see the connection. And that is why I felt there was a need to look at our Mother Earth from the universe, and from the universe looking down that beautiful earth, that earth looks blue. It's as blue as can be. And therefore, I think we need to look out of the box. We have to look into that wonderful earth. And by the way, green is the color of chlorophyll, and chlorophyll is just one of the chemical processes. It happens to be the process of the plants. But if we integrate the mushrooms, which are never green or nearly never green, they're all exceptions. You include the plants, the bacteria, and the algae. Well, you know, then things don't look as green as used to be. And we may even forget that, according to the biologists, chlorophyll is one of the most recent chemical reactions that we've invented. There were many other chemical reactions that were invented by different kingdoms beforehand. So, and perhaps it's part of my naughty character to upset sometimes people's minds. And then I want to remind people that perhaps my role is not to please people, but to wake them up and to feel uncomfortable so they can start thinking about it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. All right, thank you. Just to add, next year I hope to have a project on integrated system using rabbits and fish farming. And what I would like to do is to provide a broader perspective as what Gunther has provided. Yeah. Now we have one last question, and after that I pass the floor to the chairperson Gary, who will thank Gunther for this session. So now Kaushik.
Dr. Gunther, thank you so much for the presentation. I really enjoyed it. My background is I have no knowledge of biology. So as an engineer, what can I do as I have aspirations as an entrepreneur. So how do I channel my energy, and how do I fit into the blue economy?
Consider yourself fortunate. You know nothing about biology. You're the same as me. You know, I know so little about the real workings of biology. What I have learned over the last years is that if you want to have predictable outcomes with biology, your only option is GMO, because biology is always laced with exceptions, and biology will always be in a path of evolution, means that everything changes all the time. As an engineer, I would suggest that you get a little bit deeper into the laws of physics again. And my book actually has a special chapter on the importance of the laws of physics. Time doesn't allow me to go into detail. We can perhaps do it on the future session. But the laws of physics are critical, and let me just give you one simple example as a mind teaser for everyone to walk away from this meeting, for which I'm very grateful it was possible to do it. We all learn the law of gravity. We all learn how apple goes down from the tree. Interestingly enough, we never teach anyone how the apple got up in the tree in the first place. Now, how did that tree first defy the law of gravity and then submit itself to the law of gravity? Now, I sometimes in private meetings challenge my friend scientists, please explain me the seven forces that we have identified up to now, maybe there are others, but which are the seven forces that succeed all the ingredients of the apple to defy the law of gravity first, before subjecting itself? And I think that's the kind of innovative science that we're needing now. When I look at a good portion of the innovations that we've identified, we have to realize that the framework of operations for our ecosystems are the laws of physics. And the laws of physics are very often determined by very simple factors. It is temperature and pressure. And from there on, you can really derive a lot of the innovations that you can substantiate, which are predictable and which are important. One small case. If I have bacteria in water, our solution, since it's a bacteria problem, it's a biological problem, has become chemical. We switch from chemistry, from biology to chemistry to control the biota. So we add triclosan, we add chlorine. We ask ourselves, how does the proliferation of bacteria be controlled by natural systems? Well, in ecosystems, if there's no water, then you have no life. So it's water that controls the flow and the livelihood of bacteria. And how does it do it? By simply creating within the vortex areas in the water without air and areas in the water with air. And the complete cascading of with air and without air, aerobic and anaerobic, in the water allows water to cleanse itself from unwanted bacteria. Now, that's fascinating, because if I can control the bacteria through a vortex, because that's the way water moves naturally, if I can control bacteria through a vortex, I don't need chlorine anymore. I'd
just like to say that Gunther, this meeting certainly exceeded my very high expectations, both for what we would hear from you and the questions and quality of the discussion we've had. So I'd like to thank you again. And I'm very conscious of the fact that it's way past midnight there already in Singapore, and we've been stretching the limits of what's a reasonable demand on a speaker, even one as traveled and dynamic as you are. You know, I'd just like to end. There's so much you have said, and there would absolutely impossible to even think of summarizing it, but I thought actually your last comments struck home most profoundly to me, because perhaps we really are on the verge of a new paradigm in our understanding of life on Earth, where perhaps we've been taking the laws of physics a little too literally, in the sense that we have bought into this idea of conservation of energy, conservation of mass, whereas the thing that seems to differentiate physical systems from life systems is that life systems are able to grow and multiply and create what has not been there before. And so I think in your comments on economics, that you are really dealing with a very profound issue. We've had a lot of Nobel Prizes, as you know, in economics go to former physicists or mathematicians who brought their econometric models to the field of economics. But I think that we really do need to explore the type of approach that you have been advocating to really understand economics as a life science, a human life science, which is creating things that are not there and creating, as you have said in your presentation or in the one I read earlier, something out of nothing. So with that, you've given us all a lot to think about, and whether we can sleep or not. So I'd like to thank all of you for your participation, active participation, stimulating participation. And I certainly hope Gunther will have further opportunity to interact with you and spread the word about what you're doing. Thank you all. Anyone can turn on their microphone now. This is the time so that we can all hear you. There you are.
Hi.
Hi. Okay. Gunther, where do we go from here?
Tokyo.
We wish you a safe and pleasant journey.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.